on this first day of November 2011 in San Diego. We are reading from the Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. We are in Chapter 5, Karma Yoga, Action in Krishna Consciousness, texts 27 and 28. 527. Sparshan kritva bahir bayangsh Chakshus chayvantare bruvo Pranapanao samau kritva Nasabhyantadacharinau Yatendriya mano buddhir Mune moksha parayanaha Vigate cha bhaya krodho Yaksada mukta eva saha. Translation. Shutting out all external sense objects, keeping the eyes and vision concentrated between the two eyebrows, suspending the inward and outward breaths within the nostrils, and thus controlling the mind, senses, and intelligence, the transcendentalist aiming at liberation becomes free from desire, fear, and anger. One who is always in this state is certainly liberated. Purport. Being engaged in Krishna consciousness, one can immediately understand one's spiritual identity. And then one can understand the Supreme Lord by means of devotional service. When one is well situated in devotional service, one comes to the transcendental position, qualified to feel the presence of the Lord in the sphere of one's activity. This particular position is called liberation in the Supreme. After explaining the above principles of liberation in the Supreme, the Lord gives instruction to Arjuna as to how one can come to that position by the practice of the mysticism or yoga known as Ashtanga Yoga, which is divisible into an eightfold procedure called Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. In the sixth chapter, the subject of yoga is explicitly detailed. And at the end of the fifth, it is only preliminarily explained. One has to drive out the sense objects such as sound, touch, form, taste, and smell by the pratyahara process in yoga, and then keep the vision of the eyes between the two eyebrows and concentrate on the tip of the nose with half-closed lids. There is no benefit in closing the eyes altogether, because then there is every chance of falling asleep. Nor is there benefit in opening the eyes completely, because then there is the hazard of being attracted by sense objects. The breathing movement is restrained within the nostrils by neutralizing the up-moving and down-moving air within the body. By practice of such yoga, one is able to gain control over the senses, refrain from outward sense objects, and thus prepare oneself for liberation in the Supreme. This yoga process helps one become free from all kinds of fear and anger, and thus feel the presence of the Supersoul in the transcendental situation. In other words, Krishna consciousness is the easiest process of executing yoga principles. This will be thoroughly explained in the next chapter. A Krishna conscious person, however, being always engaged in devotional service, does not risk losing his senses to some other engagement. This is a better way of controlling the senses than by Ashtanga Yoga. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gyanandana Shalakaya Chukshu Unmilatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisance unto him and all members of Sri Parampara. So here we have two verses that pretty much foreshadow the next chapter about Ashtanga Yoga. And why are they included? Well, Prabhupada talks here about this phrase, liberation in the Supreme. Now, liberation in the Supreme, if you remember from yesterday, if you look at, you know, text 26 and text 25 and text 24, the phrase Brahma Nirvana is used. Brahma Nirvana in all three verses. This phrase is also used at the very end of the second chapter. Is Brahma Nirvana. So this is what Prabhupada translates as liberation in the Supreme. And the meaning is that what is liberation? What is liberation in general? What is liberation for a devotee? Well, liberation in general means liberation from all of your reactions from previous fruitive activities, even the ones that are not sinful. There's fruitive activities that are against the rules of the Vedas, and there are those that are in accord with the rules of the Vedas. But both of those are binding. The ones that are against, we commonly call sin, give more suffering. But even the ones that are in accord with the Vedic scriptures, such as the Karmakanda section of the Vedas, still keep one bound in this material world. And you're going to suffer birth, old age, disease, and death anyway, and some variety of the threefold miseries. It's just that sinful reactions, you suffer much more. You may actually lose a human form of life. It's hellish. But in either case, you're bound up. So preliminary mukti, basic mukti, means to be free of all those reactions, especially the sinful ones, but all the reactions. But how is that liberation actually practical in this world? So in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we find this definition in the second canto of mukti. Mukti hidvanyata rupam swarupena vivastati. So it's not something impersonal without a form. It doesn't mean that you have no senses, no mind, no nothing. You simply merge into Brahman, and you're conscious of being conscious. And that's it. No details. You know, that's not mukti according to the Bhagavatam. The very word rupa is used there. Rupa means form. So mukti hitva anyata rupam means giving up all these other rupas that we've had, these other forms that we've had, which are records of our desires. The very things that we're trying to get liberated from have caused this body. We all have a different body. That means we have different set of activities and desires that we've cultivated in previous lives and has brought us to this point. So mukti means to give all of those other forms up and to be situated in one's swarup. This word swarup is very important. It means to be situated in one's actual form, eternal form. We have an eternal form. Eternally, constitutionally, we're not without form. We're not just particles of spirit, impersonal spirit. We're persons. Persons means we have form, activities, name, place, and all these other things. But the eternal form that we have is in relation to Krishna's form, which is eternal. His form is certainly eternal. And so, like they have this phrase, you know, form follows function. Have you ever heard that? Form follows function. So that's precisely what kind of form we have. The function is our eternal relationship with Krishna. A certain kind of activity, a certain kind of desire for a specific kind of service within roughly the five rasas, or the four rasas, serving, being a friend, parent, or lover of Krishna. Somehow or other, and if you read Krishna Leela, there's so many forms, right? This is the cowherd girls, the cowherd boys, the parents, the cows, the birds, the land of Vrindavan is full of persons. Of different kind, all performing the specific service of Krishna. It wouldn't be the same if there weren't the birds. It wouldn't be the same if there wasn't the bees, right? The flowers of all varieties. They're all fully Krishna conscious. They're all fully conscious beings. So that's mukti. Now, the reason why you can stay free of these material desires is because you have other desires. You have pure desires. In service to Krishna. And these other fruit of desires don't even enter into your mind anymore. That's all been a bad dream. This whole material life we've had, millions and millions of births, each of us is trillions of years old. We just happen to be sitting here in this particular dhoti and kurta, or material body. You know, it's just a set of clothes. But inside, as spiritual beings, we're millions of years old. Physical body doesn't mean anything. It's just a record of previous activity. So, now back to the verse. So, this Brahman Nirvana is the key concept here. How to attain it, that's the question. How to come to that point of being completely free and cleansed from every vestige of fruit of desire or fruit of idea or reaction. So, one of the ways is describing here. this Ashtanga Yoga process is being, you know, given in sutra form here. So let's see what he says. So the first thing is shutting out all external sense objects. Now, right away you can see this is not our process, right? We're totally involved in the sense objects, but trying to use them for Krishna. Look at this temple. Everywhere you look, there's some, you know, something beautiful. There's nice fragrance. There's the prasadam. Certainly many sounds, transcendental sounds. Every sense. Even the sense of touch. You touch the lamp, right? You know, every sense is being used. The hands, the feet, everything. So, but this can by shutting out all external sense objects, you do shut out the material objects. So it's kind of a negative process. Keeping the eyes and vision concentrated. So the idea is that the eyes tend to wander, right? Looking for something to enjoy. So they have to be controlled. You can shut the eye, but if you shut the eyes, you start dreaming and you fall asleep. Prabhupada, he gives some wonderful lectures on this in the sixth chapter. He witnessed this. You know, he came to New York. He was staying at Dr. Mishra's ashram, and he would see the meditation process, how in within 5 minutes they're, you know, falling asleep. I also experienced that. I tried to do that. It's very difficult just to, you know, without heavy, you know, training, to just sit there and suddenly the mind tends to really race, you know, here and there. So anyway, we even have our own problem with that, you know, falling asleep during meditation. So therefore, you keep the eyes between the two eyebrows, half closed. As Prabhupada says, if you're fully open, you're going to start looking around. If you're fully closed, you fall asleep, so half open. Now, the breath. Breath is very important. I used to practice a little pranayama, you know. And it's a wonderful way, really, to calm the mind. Believe it or not, there is some recommendation for pranayama, even the Hari Bhakti Vilas. Yes. So it's not entirely, you know, whatever works. In other words, it's a way of calming the mind so that you can then think of Krishna. It's not calming the mind for its own sake, but so that you can better concentrate. We all know that a lot of times the ability to concentrate depends on some external thing. If you ate too much last night, it's very hard to concentrate on your rounds, right? It's just harder. The body's giving you so much. The way you sit, you know, as Krishna will explain, with neck, back, and head in a straight line. Well, you know, they didn't have the zafus, certainly not the beach ball zafus in the tradition, but it helps. So why not use it? It helps like anything to keep the back straight, you know? So this is just a technique. These are just techniques. The pratyahara. Pratyahara just really means withdrawing the senses from the sense objects, you know? But it's an artificial process. We want to withdraw the senses from material sense objects and place them on Krishna. You know, the basic withdrawal is the sound. It's the sound. It's the key to hear transcendental sound and to eschew material sound. It means to reject. This utsrijya is used, you know, utsrijya, throw it far away. So, but here the pranayama is mentioned, thus controlling the mind. The mind really, you know, if you watch the breath and you control it, you know, you're watching it and you regulate, you know, in and out, sometimes hold this way, that way, balance the nadis. There's all of these subtle energy strings going up in the spine called nadis, and it's a whole science. And if you purify those and you balance and everything, then it's easier to control the mind, you know. But the problem is, you know, controlling the mind just for its own sake isn't going to help ultimately. You have to have that object of meditation. And Krishna is the best object. That's why I always like to point out, when he goes through the whole sixth chapter, which really, in more detail, but not in great detail, but more detail than here, gives you the Ashtanga Yoga process. But then at the end, what does Arjuna do? He rejects it, right? He said it's not practical. Certainly it's not practical for Arjuna. He's a fighting man. They're on a battlefield. That's not the place you practice Ashtanga Yoga. If Arjuna were to take it up, he'd have to leave the battlefield. So Krishna is not really recommending it. He's detailing it, showing the benefits, so that Arjuna could recommend it. And then at the beginning of the seventh chapter, he gives a practical way that we can be yogis without all of the business of, you know, pranayama and all that business. And that's why he says, maya sakta mana partha. Now I'm going to tell you how you can have your mind naturally attracted to me. If your mind is naturally attracted to the object of meditation, then what's the difficulty? There's no difficulty in meditating. The problem is that you're meditating on something that you're then diverted by something else you want to think about. So this is the key. The seventh chapter naturally follows from the sixth. Krishna says that the greatest yogi is one who's always thinking of me in the heart with great faith. He's the best yogi. So now I'm going to teach you how you can do that in a dynamic form of yoga while performing your duty as a kshatriya. You can still be absorbed in me, even better than the Ashtanga yogis. So let's go through this purport. There's a lot of interesting points here. So one can understand one's spiritual identity, engaged in Krishna consciousness. He can understand immediately his spiritual identity, and then one can understand the Supreme Lord by means of devotional service. Now, when one is well situated in devotional service, one comes to the transcendental position qualified to feel the presence of the Lord in the sphere of one's activity. Notice that in the seventh chapter, Krishna is saying that, look, what are you experiencing? Certain tastes, you see certain things, you smell certain things, you touch certain things, right? Know that this is all my energy. So if you really remember that Rasa Homa Sukhanta, at the taste of water or any beverage, is Krishna, then you're going to be remembering Krishna whenever you drink anything. Whenever you see the sunlight and moonlight, Krishna says, I'm the sun and the moonlight. You'll be thinking of Krishna. You see how it works? So you'll be able to feel the Lord in the sphere of one's activity. But the real key is that your desires are tuned in to Krishna. So that as you walk, as you talk, as you do something, plan, or whatever you do, is for the sake of Krishna, then you feel the presence of Krishna in one's activity. Because you're not doing it for yourself, you're doing it for Krishna. It's so visceral. The example given by the Goswamis is that a wife has a paramour, So she's doing her service, but she's always thinking, when will I meet the paramour? Right? She's doing her household activities. So if you develop some affection for Krishna and you understand the philosophy of how he's present in everything, then how can you forget him? If you're truly acting for him. But it starts with karma yoga. So even though your mind might be going a million, not remembering Krishna per se, still you're working for Krishna. There's no karmic reaction. You're still being purified. But it requires that we come from karma yoga to jnana yoga, and then to meditative yoga, and finally to bhakti yoga. It includes all the others. You're working for Krishna, you're thinking of Krishna, you're meditating on Krishna, you're loving Krishna. Krishna, 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 Krishna. There's a nice passage. I'm thinking now of the DVDs that Yadubar made. Go way back to 1966. And there's a devotee named Damodar. He's one of the first devotees that joined at that time. And he says, and Prabhupada, at one time, I don't know how many devotees were there. It may have been just a handful. Or just Damodar himself. He said, and Prabhupada is saying, Krishna consciousness, the residents in Vrindavan, they're leading the ideal Krishna conscious life. And he says, it's Krishna, 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 Krishna. And he just went on like that, saying Krishna, 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 Krishna. Everything they do, everything they think, every motion, every emotion is related to Krishna. And Prabhupada, he says, he almost went into a trance. It's Krishna, 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 Krishna. And that's Krishna consciousness. It doesn't restrict you. It opens up. But you see everything. You see the divine everywhere. It's simple. Like that very, I forget, Robert Blake. Was it Robert Blake? Not Robert Blake. William Blake wrote the poem, to see God in a grain of sand and in the blade of grass, whatever. Yeah, he had some inkling of it. That's precisely what it is. And you can see it, Prabhupada had that vision. It was never outside of Krishna consciousness. Everything he did, every breath, every word, it was for the sake of Krishna. And that's the most, what does he call it in the first canto? Congenial form of intimacy. The congenial form of intimacy. If you're always serving someone out of love and you're trying to please them, naturally you're going to be absorbed in thought of them. And remember, Krishna is the Supreme Brahman. That is Brahman Nirvana. That is truly Brahman Nirvana. Both parts of the philosophy have to be there. Mahat was talking about the head and the heart. You know? So the head of the intellectual aspect, you remember Buddhi Yoga? He talked so much about Buddhi Yoga at the beginning, second chapter, Prabhupada's emphasizing. Got to use your head, intelligence. But ultimately it culminates in the feeling. Both balance there. You're aware of Krishna's presence everywhere, of his energy and everything, but you're working for him. You're relating to him affectionately. There's a personal thing that's going on at the same time. Both of the ideas are kind of held at the same time. Now, sometimes the personal just overwhelms the other and you forget. You know, the great devotees, they forget, you know, by Krishna's grace, by Yogamaya, Krishna's majesty and, you know, his all of that power to just relate on a very sweet, intimate level. But, you know, that's really how you can always think of Krishna, is by really becoming attracted to him. You know, and we're given so much opportunity. You know, all this chanting of the holy name, the deities, we're given plenty. But we're also given plenty of philosophy here. So this position is called liberation in the Supreme. Liberation in the Supreme is Prabhupada's phrase, translating Brahma Nirvana. This is true Brahma Nirvana, being Krishna conscious and feeling Krishna's presence in all one's activities. And then he goes, and Prabhupada goes through the Ashtanga principles here, eight principles. And let's see. It's a standard, you know, this is a standard trope, if you will, for Ashtanga Yoga. You go through it, and he said, but it's not really practical. The best way to do it is by being Krishna conscious, and that's how he ends the purport. A Krishna conscious person, however, being always engaged in devotional service, does not risk losing his senses to some other engagement. This is a better way of controlling his senses than by Ashtanga Yoga. It's not only better, but it's practical for us, you know. I mean, I remember way back when I was, you know, I was kind of going from this yoga studio to that yoga studio. And, you know, we had, just like here, we have seniors, you know, someone who's been around for a while, and we have juniors, you know. So there was a fellow who was a senior in the practice of Ashtanga Yoga. It means like he was doing it for 3-4 years, you know. And, you know, we'd have that, I think he dressed a little bit like a yogi. I don't know, I forget how it was, but it wasn't ordinary dress. And, you know, we had heard, oh, he can meditate for 3 hours at a time, you know, and like that. But, I mean, if I recall, like, it's been a long time, there was nothing particularly transcendental, you know what I mean? In other words, he was absorbed in ordinary things of making a living and doing this and whatever, you know. You didn't get the sense of like the devotees where your whole life is transformed, you know what I mean? But he had some experience. I remember he kind of had these saucer eyes, you know. He just got this vision that, you know, practicing for a long time, he established some kind of other consciousness, you know. But it wasn't something that was that attractive, you know, to be like that. And later on, as time went on, you heard of people getting into this kind of yoga and going nuts practically. Like with the Kundalini, you know, there's a power there that you come through this. If you don't know what you're doing and you try to awaken that, you can really become psychotic. Yeah. And so, I mean, we've had so many, you know, communes and this and that, but what really is substantial, you see, devotees are able to stay steady for years and decades at a time, you know, and give up real, you know, involvement with the material contaminations. So this is really a practical yoga if we want to be successful. Okay, any questions? Yeah, Haribol.
This section actually is preparing one for liberation. And I was just reading chapter 7 and I was curious. Krishna is basically saying that one who is freed from sinful reactions is eligible for liberation. More or less, it's, you know, which verse 7:28?
Yeah, yeah, it's Chadresha Samatena.
No, this one, a person who has acted healthily in this life and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated. Oh, wait, actually that one that you're talking about, these verses. Because the sinful reactions, why is that necessary for sinful reactions?
So that's 28, right?
Well,
yeah, Nirmukta, Dvanda Mohan Nirmukta. Which verse are you looking at? 27?
It was actually sinful reactions. So, whichever one you just quoted.
Well, the standard one is Yesham Drantakatam Papam, is and in this life, and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated. Now, you have to remember this action and reaction. Sometimes they're.
I thought it became really sinful reactions, and I was wondering why. I mean, obviously, sinful actions, they can't be sinful actions, but why do their reactions have to be?
Well, the idea is that when you practice devotional service, or any kind of yoga, but especially devotional service, you're negating all of these, you know, these different aspects of reaction to sin. There's the bija, the kuta, the aprarabdha, and the prarabdha. So the bija is a specific desire to perform a similar sin. The kuta, according to Mahatattva that I haven't researched, is kind of the tendency to keep sinning in general. But the idea, if you do something against the laws of nature, laws of God, you'll have a tendency to do it again. Because the only reason you do it is some pleasure there, immediate pleasure. But it sets a certain vritti in the mind, a certain habit. This is what the conditioning is. And you tend to do it again. You know, this is the experience. So that's part of the reaction. The reaction just isn't the manifest suffering that you get, the prarabdha karma. There's also these other stages. So to become free of sin entirely means to become free of all of that result of sin. And that means to be free of the tendency to sin, of the manifest and unmanifest suffering that's coming from it. So in order to become that, you have to be free of the delusion of duality. You know, Krishna mentions that at the end of the seventh chapter, as he pointed out, that in order to be fixed in devotion, which alone can really give you liberation, one has to meet this requirement in text 28. They've acted piously in previous lives and in this life, punya karmana, and whose sinful actions are completely eradicated. So, antakatam papam, completely eradicated sin. Then they are freed from the dualities of delusion and they engage themselves in my service with determination. So there are different stages of liberation or purification, let's say. And to be fully determined, in the path of devotional service, one certainly has to stop the activities of sin. Now there still may be some vestiges of sinful reaction, just like we have in the second chapter, first canon, that I chant every morning for class, Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu, Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. So Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu, it means that the impurities in the heart, some of which are caused by sin, are almost completely destroyed. Prayeshu means almost completely. Then one can be Nishta, one can be determined. So I think that in this particular verse that you cited from the seventh chapter, Yesham Tantakatam Papam, he's referring to actual sinful activities. Papa is, the sinful activity can mean also. And that then when the process of devotional service acts very quickly and you can become determined in devotional service. You know, one is beyond the dualities of delusion. One is steady, in other words, in happiness and distress, and is still, determined in practice. Okay, should we move on? Go ahead.
Yeah, one last question. You were saying that Krishna wasn't actually recommending Ashtanga. He's basically just explaining it to Arjuna. Why exactly was he explaining it? Just to basically show that he
did? Well, the thing is, if you go, this is every work of literature as grows out of the contemporary times that is spoken of. And so there are persons who practice karma yoga, jnana yoga. There's certainly many who are attracted to Ashtanga yoga. But all of these, Krishna is saying, well, this is a step on the ladder. This doesn't really take you all the way, or it's very difficult. You see, the Ashtanga yoga, there's many good things about it. There's really some important instructions in that chapter. But the process itself is not really practical for us. And Arjun kind of represents every man, if you will, although he's highly exalted. And he says, oh, the mind is much too difficult to control. And certainly, for us to practice Ashtanga yoga. So for those who are attracted to Ashtanga yoga, here are the benefits, but here's why you know, it's very, very difficult to achieve, to practice in this age. Certainly, you have to follow the instructions. You have to go off alone. Not even, you know, any hint of sex. And there's, you know, living alone. Who can live alone like that? And finding that, you know, secluded, sacred place. Even in India, it's very hard to find that now. You know, no matter where you go, there's tourists coming around, there's the loudspeakers, you know. I mean, you can still do that. But that's not recommended for the age, you know. And so we want the benefits of Ashtanga Yoga, but we can't, you know, practice it. So what to do? Oh, chapter 7. Like I said, Mayasakta Mano. Now I'm going to teach you how you can achieve this absorption in me. After all, the ultimate goal is samadhi, complete absorption in Krishna, in the absolute, you know, within and without. So now here's the process how you can do that. So for all those who are attracted to Ashtanga Yoga, please read the 6th chapter, find out why you should give it up, and take up Bhakti Yoga and achieve the ends in a practical, easy way. Take the elevator, Prabhupada says, to the, you know, high floor. So that's the idea. You know, for those who attract the Karmakanda, you know, section of the Vedas, okay, we have in the 2nd chapter. And don't be attracted to the flowery words of the Vedas, you know. To those who want to, you know, speculate, all right, we have the Jnana Yoga chapter. But that, you know, culminates ultimately in meditation on Krishna. But to really meditate on Krishna properly and practically, you have to practice Bhakti Yoga. So really the end of the whole book is about Bhakti Yoga. But he's taking those of different interests and bringing it to the point. Okay, you ready for the peace formula? That's the last verse of the chapter. Bhoktaram yangitapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram sudidam sarvabhutanam gyatpa mam shantamrichati. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the supreme lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Purport. The conditioned souls within the clutches of the illusory energy are all anxious to attain peace in the material world. But they do not know the formula for peace, which is explained in this part of the Bhagavad Gita. The greatest peace formula is simply this. Lord Krishna is the beneficiary in all human activities. Men should offer everything to the transcendental service of the Lord, because he is the proprietor of all planets and the demigods thereon. No one is greater than he. He is greater than the greatest of the demigods, Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma. In the Vedas, the Shvetashvara Upanishad 6-7, the Supreme Lord is described as Tamishvaranam Padamam Maheshwaram. Under the spell of illusion, living entities are trying to be lords of all they survey, but actually they are dominated by the material energy of the Lord. The Lord is the master of material nature, and the conditioned souls are under the stringent rules of material nature. Unless one understands these bare facts, it is not possible to achieve peace in the world, either individually or collectively. This is the sense of Krishna consciousness. Lord Krishna is the supreme predominator, and all living entities, including the great demigods, are his subordinates. One can attain perfect peace only in complete Krishna consciousness. This 5th chapter is a practical explanation of Krishna consciousness, generally known as Karma Yoga. The question of mental speculation as to how Karma Yoga can give liberation is answered herewith. To work in Krishna consciousness is to work with the complete knowledge of the Lord as the predominator. Such work is not different from transcendental knowledge. Direct Krishna consciousness is Bhakti Yoga, and Jnana Yoga is a path leading to Bhakti Yoga. Krishna consciousness means to work in full knowledge of one's relationship with the Supreme Absolute, and the perfection of this consciousness is full knowledge of Krishna, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. A pure soul is the eternal servant of God as his fragmental part and parcel. He comes into contact with Maya or illusion, due to the desire to lord it over Maya, and that is the cause of his many sufferings. As long as he is in contact with matter, he has to execute work in terms of material necessities. Krishna consciousness, however, brings one into spiritual life even while one is within the jurisdiction of matter. for it is an arousing of spiritual existence by practice in the material world. The more one is advanced, the more he is freed from the clutches of matter. The Lord is not partial toward anyone. Everything depends on one's practical performance of duties in Krishna consciousness, which helps one control the senses in every respect and conquer the influence of desire and anger. And one who stands fast in Krishna consciousness, controlling the above-mentioned passions, remains factually in the transcendental stage, or Brahma Nirvana. The Eightfold Yoga mysticism is automatically practiced in Krishna consciousness because the ultimate purpose is served. There is a gradual process of elevation in the practice of Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi. But these only preface perfection by devotional service, which alone can award peace to the human being. It is the highest perfection of life. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports to the fifth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita in the matter of karma yoga, or action in Krishna consciousness. So, I have read this chapter many times, and if someone can tell me I'm wrong, please do. But I think that this last line of this last verse is the first time in the chapter that Krishna mentions himself. He's been talking about Brahma Nirvana, Brahma Yukta, and all of these different things. But finally he says, I'm talking about me. Gyatva mam shantamichati. So it's interesting here. So, bhoktaram yagatapasam. Now, Prabhupada, you know, he very much pressed this as the peace formula. Now, it's interesting that there's kind of two sections here where he talks about peace. You remember in the second chapter, there was a lot about peace. You remember that? Peace there is defined as being, sense control, basically. He says, Vihai kama nyaksavam pumam chadari nikspahar nimimonda bahankara sa shanti madigachati. So, vihai kama, giving up material desires, all of them, sarvan. Pumam chadari nikspahar, living free of such desire. Nirmamo, having no sense of false proprietorship, everything belongs to Krishna. Nirahankara, no false ego, I'm a servant of Krishna. Sa shanti madigachati. You see, that's one attains peace. So that's one understanding. I mean, they're not actually, of course, contradictory, but that's very much a personal peace, right? That's very much, I can be at peace. But this is really a social thing. Sarva lokamahe, sarva bhutanam. You know, one sees Krishna as the friend of every living being, the best friend, that he is the enjoyer of all sacrifices and austerities. Now, people may not call them jagya and tapasa, but everyone is performing some kind of sacrifice and some kind of austerity. It's a big sacrifice for an ordinary man to get up early in the morning, go to work, earn money, come home, pay the bills, send his kid to college, medical bills, you know. A lot of tapasya there, and a lot of sacrifice, right? But he doesn't regard Krishna as the enjoyer. I'm the enjoyer, my family's the enjoyer. Maybe I'll give a contribution to this politician or this charity or something like that. But Krishna is not part of the equation, you know. Sarva Loka Maheshanam, why is he the enjoyer of all the jagyas and the tapasya? Because he's the Ishvara of all of every loka, of every planet and every person in it. Loka can mean the planet or it can mean the persons in the planet, right? So Krishna is the actual Ishvara. And that is, you know, that is like the first principle, right? Ishvara Parama Krishna. What does it say? Isha Vasham Idam Sarvam. The very first word of the Isha Upanishad after the invocation is Isha. So this principle of Isha is very important. The controller, you know. We're all controllers, you know. We may control our little corner in the ashram, and somebody's controlling the city of San Diego, you know. And it depends how much Aishwarya you got. Aishwarya means money or wealth. And notice the relation between the word Aishwarya and Ishwara. Yeah. If you have a lot of money, then you're a bigger Ishwara. You know? So, but, someone thinks he's a big Ishwara. You know, the demons, right? Whether they're big demons like Aranyakashipu or Ravana, or little demons like we have today, they think, I'm in control. But then after a while, they're not in control. You know, and the time takes them off, or some enemy, or some disease, or whatever, right? You can't control it. No matter how much you want to, you're pushed off the pedestal and you're not in control. So we want to find that supreme controller, that supreme lord, of whom all the other big lords are servants. Brahma bows down, Shiva bows down, Indra bows down, and all of their millions of subordinates bow down because they know he's the actual controller. And that means to follow his instructions. And then it means that he's the enjoyer of whatever sacrifice, whatever austerity we perform. And that he's the best friend. That's another thing. Now, I always think of the preaching movement when I see this one. Because what are we actually doing, you know, when we try to give somebody Krishna consciousness in the form of a book or just instruction, Harinam, Prasadam, whatever it may be, come to the temple. We're trying to introduce them to their best friend. Their best friend, who's right in their heart. Right? He's in the heart. Suhrit. Rit means the heart. So then you become the best friend, in a sense, right? The best friend in this world is the devotees. Krishna says that in the morning class, right? We just read it. That my devotees are actually the best friends of everybody because they're giving them the most valuable thing, you know? And actually, a real devotee also cares. You know, he cares. It's a paradukaduki. Oh, here's this poor person. All these people are suffering without this knowledge, without understanding who they are, without understanding who their best friend is, right? So, if you actually live these principles, understanding that Krishna is all of these things, then you can have peace in your heart. Why isn't there peace? Because people are competing with Krishna, because they're grabbing onto the impermanent things. They want something that they don't have, right? Anyone who wants something material can never be satisfied because the kama is ever increasing, burns like fire, is never satiated. So everyone who's a kami, means it has kama, cannot be satisfied. Bhukti mukti siddhi kami. Sakala ashanta, Lord Chaitanya says. Krishna bhakta nishkama ata eva shanta. The Krishna bhakta is not nishkama. He has no personal desire, it's all for Krishna. That kind of desire brings you peace. Because you can always have it. Anywhere, any place, any person. You're sitting in, you know, sometimes I dream like this. I'm sitting in solitary confinement. Maybe they'll round us up someday. But, you know, are we ever in solitary confinement? You're never alone. Krishna's always there. They can never put a devotee in solitary confinement. Even if they, you know, put us in what they think is solitary. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You get a lot of rounds chanted. And we've seen it, actually, the prison ministry. You should read some of these guys' letters. Have you ever seen? They're getting very advanced. Because they're just chanting. First of all, they're chanting with great feeling and desperation. And they're chanting a lot. I remember back in 81, there was this prisoner in Bordentown Prison near Philadelphia. And I would visit him periodically. Jeez. He, you know, all he did all day, he was doing some martial arts because, you know, guys were attacking him and stuff. So he was like, you know, defending himself. He was taking care of himself. But mostly he was reading Chaitanya Charitamrita, chanting Hare Krishna all day, you know, writing letters to me basically at that point. And then I would see him and we would just sit. It wasn't a high security prison. So we would actually sit in the, you know, chairs at a table in the place where other prisoners were. And we'd just talk about Krishna. You know, and unfortunately he got out, and you know, once he saw the bouts, we weren't able to keep him in the temple. He got a little restless, you know, that happens sometimes. But now the ministry is much more developed. There's books everywhere, you know, and it's amazing. You know, I remember this is something I've never spoken of. When I was a kid, you know, it wasn't that long after World War II when I grew up. I grew up in the 50s. And, you know, 60s. And so we still had some of these songs going on from the days of the war. And we belonged to a Jewish family and everything. So there was this song, Die Gedanken sind frei, da, 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 da. And what that meant is the thoughts are free. They can lock us up and put us in this concentration camp, but our thoughts are free and we can, you know, dream of this and that. It's really kind of a desperate song. But in truth, if you're able to be Krishna conscious, then they... Oh, here's another story. Then you can be happy even in that situation. The early 80s, this is when the devotees were fighting for legitimacy in Bombay. The temple was built, but there was still a lot of opposition. And so at one point, there was this effort to get the devotees to close down the temple in Bombay. And somebody paid to have like a mini riot going on outside the gates of the temple. So we had the gates closed up, and we had our guard, you know. And this guard, there was some fellow who was yelling and screaming, maybe he was throwing something. And one of the guards hit him on the head and killed him. And that caused a huge uproar, and they came and arrested the leadership of the temple. I know several of the devotees who they arrested. And they were in jail. And we had a big legal thing, you know, to say, well, it's not our fault, it was an accident, isn't it? But in the meanwhile, they were in jail. Excuse me. So, but they were seen by the other prisoners. It's just like Haridas Thakur, you know, where he went into the jail, and all the prisoners, many of whom were pious Hindus who the Muslims had locked up, you know, for insubordination, they all bowed down and they revered Haridas Thakur, you know. And he blessed them and said, may you stay as you are now. And they said, well, come on, give us a blessing, get us out of here. What are you telling me? Then he laughed. He said, no, I don't mean that stay in prison, but stay as you are now in this mood of respect and veneration and, you know, Krishna consciousness. But anyway, so these devotees were locked up. And, of course, they had each other. And so they were doing kirtans. And then they decided, because they had read in an extra devotion how you can do puja in your mind, you know. You know, if you ever can't have a temple, you can just sit there and do elaborate puja, you know, even much better than we can actually, you know, you cook the most opulent prasadam, the dressing with real gold and jewels and everything, you know, aratik 7 times a day, chanting. So you can do that. It's perfectly legitimate and accepted by Krishna. So they started doing these elaborate aratis, all with imaginary stuff. You know, they would, and the guards would watch them, you know, aghast, and the other prisoners, you know. And they're doing the RT, and they're doing the kirtan, and they're distributing the prasadam, taking the feast, you know. All in the mind. And they said they'd never been as blissful as in their whole Krishna conscious career as they were at that time. Because, you know, Krishna's not limited. You know, in the material sphere, you got to have the thing or you can't be happy, right? But, and even if you do have the thing, you're not really happy because it gets stale. But in Krishna consciousness, it's after all a state of consciousness you're after. And Krishna is there. He's not different from thought of him. He's not different from his name. So you chant his name any time, any place, any circumstance. And then, you know, the more you're focused and the more you're chanting from the heart, you'll experience Krishna. The presence of Krishna in all of one's activity, Prabhupada mentioned here. So that's real peace in any circumstance. Otherwise, you can never be peaceful. Bhukti, mukti, siddhi, kama, sakaliya, shanta. Oops. I'm sorry. We're going over time. So all others, whether the materialists, gross materialists, or they want some mystic powers, or they want liberation, that's all in the realm of I want this and this, and therefore you can't be peaceful. You know, you'll never be satisfied. But if you want for Krishna everything, then you can be in perfect peace. All glories to Shiva.